proportionate political representation that you talked about, and you talked about the three keys to that, the reform, the revolution, and the third one was what was that again?
Separation.
Separation. Talk about that in reference to what we're dealing with, because I know that you wouldn't be convening this political conference if we didn't have failed leadership among black politicians that represent our people now. Talk about this and your three points in regards to what we're dealing with and what we're facing and how that can change the dynamic.
Okay. But we projected that as a way of saying that our people collectively have to begin to decide what direction do we really want to take as responding to the victimization that we constantly are dealing with in terms of the police violence, in terms of the economic redlining, in terms of just the whole white supremacist attack upon our community. And what we're saying is that part of the fight, if we don't be out there, and people have to be clear, that number one, we're dealing with a very capitalistic, imperialistic system of evilness that's visited upon us. Now, in terms of moving forward into the 21st century, we say that we have to be clear on our struggle. Part of our struggle, when we call for community reform of the police department, starting there, and as an organization, we say that we have to have community control of the police in terms of that being on three levels. So one is that all police forces in every community are to reflect the ethnicity of the community in which they patrol. Secondly, that all officers are to live within the community. Thirdly, that you are to have effective civilian oversight with subpoena power. Clearly, that's not absolutely revolutionary, but that's a step in the right direction of dealing with the issues impacting us. So that's a reform, and people ought to be clear. Revolution is another potential response, is the complete overthrow of the economic system of capitalism that we are dealing with, which is the basic foundation of pushing forward racism. That's a whole different implementation of a whole different system of life, period, in this country as an option. And then we have to look in terms of whether or not that can be made manifest given our numbers in this country, given the level of what it would take to make revolution occur. The third option that we're seeing goes back to, in a sense, the ideas of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey, as well as the thoughts of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who said that we ought to separate from these folks. That how would that separation look? Of course, the Honorable Marcus Garvey was advocating for us to have the United States of Africa, in essence, by moving totally to Africa for a certain component of our community. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad advocated for the five southern states in terms of separating from these, this system. Mm-hmm. And that's all we're saying, that's part of our discussion going forward among the progressive forces, is understanding the kind of direction that we as a collective have to be looking at, and people understanding those particular options. And so to that end, just even on the question of separation, which could also lead to, and this would in a sense be semi-autonomous status for us as a race and separation, if there was a mass migration to the southern states, where there's already a greater concentration of us as a people in terms of percentage-wise in the southern states, then we could truly begin to seize what I call state power by simply electing ourselves and seizing the state assemblies as well as the governorships of many of those states. And what happens as an extension of that? For our state government, and as a former candidate for a governor of the state of Missouri, back in 1984 and 88. Every state has can enter into international contracts with other businesses, entities, and countries outside of America. State education is a state responsibility. Then when we talk about the educational system, if we were empowered, then we can change the educational system. So those are kind of the discussions that we feel that needs to be ratcheted up moving into the 21st century. So going back to our conference, and I just want to be clear to the progressive community who's listening, we recognize that this is, as I had said earlier, a reform effort. However, it's a key reform because it takes our people, those who are afraid to venture into that thought of revolution or separation. It's just common sense saying that if you don't stay within the system, then you ought to get some basic minimal response, especially as it relates to the kind of dollars that you put into that system. So again, that goes back to the concept of proportionate representation. It's like a pie. If we all put in the pie and we at the table and just the three of us, let's say the three of us, Reggie, yourself, and me, and I keep two-thirds of it, and we put an equal share in it, then that's totally unfair. That's just insane. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening politically in our communities. So that's, again, why we're pushing this whole concept of proportionate political representation, and we're taking it, as I see it, by the stages. And like I said, at the highest level, just imagine if in those 34 states that we'll be having the elections taking place, that if we had strong black men and women, such as yourself and others, sitting on the office and addressing the prison and the gospel industry that locks us up as it does in terms of America being the leading jealous people. And when black men are only 6% of the population, a makeup of 70% of those incarcerated, these are the kinds of issues that we're looking for to be addressed by people who's willing to stand and campaign in the upcoming 2016 election. So, and it would be historic, too, that if a collection of folks seeking those offices, and again saying the same thing. But let me give you, for your listener audience, some of the states where you have the United States
citizenship. Brother Bruce, your voice is fading a little bit. It might be your cell phone. If you could.
Okay, let me move directions in. Can you hear me better?
Yes.
Now? Mm-hmm. Okay. I was just going to share with you a few of the states where you have in the United States senatorial seat up for election. And then I'll throw in the percentage of black people in those particular states.
Go ahead.
First is Louisiana, which has a percentage of 32% black. And I'm putting the percentage of black people in those states because historically in many elections, when you have progressive black candidates, you have a tendency of at least 15 to 20% of the progressive white community willing to vote for a progressive black candidate. Louisiana, 32%, as I just said. Georgia, 31%. Maryland, 30%. South Carolina, 28%. Alabama, 26%. North Carolina, 21%. Florida, 15%. Arkansas, 13%. New York, 13%. It may be 15%. I'm sorry, those last three, 15%. I should have some reading glasses at home. But right there, and I use those statistics because, as I just mentioned, if we had strong progressive black men addressing those issues, then who knows, we can very much unseat and gain those positions. And there's different strategies. We're advocating the in and out of the system strategy when it comes to elections. One strategy could simply be that we be the very, very left wing of a political party. because all, you know, we can use the Democratic Party, or else if we organize early enough, we can be independent candidates. But that's a whole nother level that we would have to look at each of the various state laws that govern, you know, independent candidacies, because that may involve a lot of signature gathering. But again, minimally, come in 2016, we ought to be up and challenging for those positions. And that's why we are, again, advocating for our National Black Political Leadership Conference.
We're in conversation tonight with St. Louis and Ferguson community leader and president general of the Universal African People's Organization, Brother Zaki Baruti. Brother Baruti, the states you mentioned earlier in conversation, besides Maryland, New York, most of those other states are in the Black Belt area.
Yep, absolutely.
At our conference here in Philadelphia, Chokwe Antal Lumumba was the son of Chokwe Lumumba, who was former vice president of the Republic of New Africa, had a strategy for the Black Belt. He won the mayor's race in Jackson until he was untimely called home to the ancestors.
Right, and I knew him very good and was on several international trips with my good brother Chokwe, a very strong brother, a visionary, and our community really lost a great soldier. I just wanted to add that.
You know, his political strategy for that area, I can see that you're operating in that same mold, because you ran for governor. You also ran for county executive, I think.
Yeah, I was a write-in candidate for that.
Okay.
Yes.
So, we see, and history kind of repeats itself if our people understand our own history. If you look at when we came out of so-called chattel enslavement during the period of Reconstruction, most of our folks that got involved in politics early on, the congressmen and a few senators, Blanche K. Bruce and others, they had a political agenda for our people. They wanted reparations. They wanted land. That's what led to the formation of that Freedmen's Bank, even though we know what happened in reference to that. But the men did have an agenda to look out for our people. That led to the formation of several black towns in the Black Belt area and a burgeoning economy among some of our towns. But now we have a black political leadership that wants to pander to other folks, pander to Europeans. We see some of the cities that was predominantly black at one time being gentrified. So we see a sickness among our people that has spread prominently among our politicians. You talked earlier in one of your YouTube broadcasts about the levels of consciousness in our community, which we talk about a lot on this program. But talk about what you referred to about the levels of consciousness and how it hinders some of our progress to a certain extent. It won't stop it. It's not going to stop our people moving forward, but it can hinder it. Talk about what you consider the levels of consciousness in our community.
Okay. Well, you know, Huey Newton Huey was one of my most admired heroes back in the early 60s, and I was an early supporter of the Black Panther Party. And he was also addressed that whole level of consciousness of our people from A to Z, you know, in terms of A on the road to I guess what you would consider the highest level of consciousness. A, you know, being that you have no perception, and these are the levels of consciousness that I'm speaking to, where you just have no understanding of your history. You know, you're just kind of like out there, you know, just existing, you know, just surviving. Have no understanding of the great historical world contribution that our people made. No understanding of the impact of the slaughter of our people during the enslavement of our people. No understanding of the heroes and the sheroes who fought and struggled against the evil system of slavery. no understanding of those such as Garvey or Honorable Elijah Muhammad or Noble Drew Ali or all the way up to like Mega Evers or what have no understanding of the countries of Africa. That's a state of complete unconsciousness. And a lot of our people are in that state. They're in that state because many of them go through an educational system that's designed to keep them ignorant. And then at the same time, they're in homes where that's not fostered. And then, of course, the media and the churches and what have you also play that part in terms of keeping the people ignorant. Then you have a level of consciousness where people do understand what is happening. They understand the oppression of our people. They may not be absolutely real knowledgeable about our history, but they understand something is at play in terms of the oppression of our people. Yes, because of fear, because of apathy, they refuse to be involved. And so that gives way to helping to maintain the status where we are as a people. Another level of consciousness are those brothers and sisters who don't know their history, who know their history and proud to be black and what have you. However, I at one point was using the theme conscious cowards who understand the problem yet are not out amongst the people making a difference. A lot of brothers who talk a good game, that's the level of that consciousness.
Were you talking about conscious cowards, you said?
I call them conscious cowards,
okay.
Yes. Okay. And then, of course, you have the levels, higher levels, where you got people who understand our great contribution and who's doing everything that they possibly can to make the transformation. And many times, or like in the old days, I use the example of the biblical characters, like a Noah, going around and say, hey, she's going to flood. Wake up, wake up. And a lot of people, and then they are waking up people, but then this government systematically shuts them down. Example, Garvey. By imprisoning Garvey to stop the movement of the powerful Universal Negro Improvement Association and the African Communities League. Another example, even Paul Robeson, one of the greatest athletes and orators and what have you. He was pressured by the United States Congress for his outspokenness. The Black Panther Party shut down through systematic murder and attack as they was raising the consciousness of us as a people. Dr. King assassinated. And, you know, we could go on and on. Malcolm X murdered. Those were people who the people were listening to, being motivated, but systematically destroyed. So to that end, though, destroy, as Chokwe used to say, we got to always concretize the struggle. We have to pass it on from one generation to another generation. And that's the task of those of us who consider ourselves conscious and who consider ourselves giving back to community, that we have to stay in the fight to keep the movement going. And by the grace of the Creator, at some point in time, we will be victorious. I always like to use a historical example of, say, Iran. I'm sure Ayatollah Khomeini, as a young man, he struggled many, many years against what was taking place in Iran with the power of the Shah, who was a student of the United States government. And I'm sure they had conversations just like you and I are having in terms of dealing with the situation and how it, to overcome it. But before he died, as an old man, he came into power to bring about a change, whether people agree with the change or not. He brought about a great social change in China. That was a commitment to that change, which is the lifelong commitment that for those who are truly conscious have to make and actualize in terms of their actions as moving forward to address the kinds of issues that we'll be talking about day in and day out.
We're going to take a
break. So I hope I answered your question.
Oh, most definitely. And we're going to continue the conversation. We're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, we'll continue the conversation with St. Louis Ferguson community activist and president general of the Universal African People's Organization, Brother Zaki Baruti. We'll be right back after a brief word from our sponsor.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
The economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we should own and operate and control the economy of our community. You would never find, you can't open up a black store in a white community. White man won't even patronize you. And he's not wrong. He got sense enough to look out for himself. And you don't have sense enough to look out for yourself. The white man is too intelligent to let someone else come and gain control of the economy of his community. But you will let anybody come in and control the economy of your community. Control the housing, control the education, control the jobs, control the businesses, under the pretext that you want to integrate. No, you're out of your mind. The economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer, the community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled and misguided are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man. The man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a run-down community. Why, you run it down yourself when you take it out.
This is what we have to do. Now, the other thing we'll have to do is this. Always anchor our external direct action with the power of economic withdrawal. Now, we are poor people. Individually, we are poor when you compare us with white society in America. We are poor. Never stop to get that collectively, that means all of us together, collectively we are richer than all the nations in the world with the exception of nine. Did you ever think about that? After you leave the United States, Soviet Russia, Great Britain, West Germany, France, and I can name others, the American Negro collectively is richer than most nations of the world. We have an annual income of more than $30 billion a year, which is more than all of the exports of the United States. And more than the national budget of Canada. Did you know that? That's power right there, if we know how to prove it. Children are concerned. Now, if you are not prepared to do that, we do have an agenda that we must follow. And our agenda calls for withdrawing economic support from you. So as a result of this, we're asking you tonight to go out and tell your neighbors not to buy Coca-Cola in Memphis. Go by and tell them not to buy sealed test milk. Tell them not to buy, what is the other bread? Wonder Bread. And what is other bread come to Jesse? Tell them not to buy hard bread. As Jesse Jackson has said, up to now, only the garbage men have been feeling pain. Now we must kind of redistribute the pain. And not only that, we've got to strengthen black institutions. I call upon you to take your money out of the banks downtown and deposit your money in Tri-State Bank. We want a bank-in movement in Memphis. Go by the Savings and Loan Association. I'm not asking you something that we don't do ourselves in SCLC. Judge Hooks and others will tell you that we have an account here in the Savings and Loan Association from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. We are telling you to follow what we are doing. Put your money there. You have six or seven black insurance companies here in the city of Memphis. Take out your insurance there. We want to have an insurance in. Now, these are some practical things that we can do. We begin the process of building a greater economic base. And at the same time, we are putting pressure where it really hurts. I ask you to follow through here. Now let me say as I move to my conclusion that we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We got to see it through.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and we're joined in conversation with St. Louis and Ferguson community leader and president general of the African People's Organization, Brother Zaki Baruti. But before we go back to the phones, we've been having trouble with the Black Talk Radio stream. It's being simulcast on www.blacktalkradionetwork.com. If you have tuned in, you can switch right over to
Elliot, can you hear me?
Yes.
It's not the Black Talk Radio stream. It's the Time for Awakening radio stream. So they want to switch to Black Talk Radio. If they just go to blacktalkradionetwork.com / Black Talk Radio, there's a media player there, and they can hear the program as it's supposed to be heard. So it's not our stream, it's your stream, but we've resolved that issue. Everything is fine. I'm making a podcast for you, so please continue.
All right. And before we continue with our guest, again, I want to let you know about the Time for Awakening Media, which will be launched within the next couple of weeks. And you'll see all types of original material being posted, original content, blogs, original articles, podcasts of the shows, Black products that we use every day in our households, and much, much more. So if you like what we do on Time for an Awakening, send us an email, like the fan page on Facebook, and get ready for Time for Awakening Media, which will be coming to you very soon. We'll be doing giveaways and things like that for our listening audience to get more interactive. So just be prepared for Time for Awakening Media, which will be coming to you shortly. Brother Rudy.
Yes, sir.
We were talking earlier about the Black Political Convention that you're convening in St. Louis on October 30th and 31st at the St. Mark Family Church on 9950 Glen Owen Street in St. Louis. You know, I was just involved in a training conference for the 1 million conscious Black voters, and I think that's what has been missing among our people since we've been involved in the voting process, since the Voting Rights Act, as a collective being involved in the voting process, that we haven't been conscious Black voters. Maybe early on we were, but I think that the consciousness has waned. We vote for popularity contests. We vote because politicians give speeches that'll tickle our ears. We vote because they have ministers surrounding them, or they get places in churches where they tell our people to vote for them and promise them nothing. And then when some of our people don't get anything, we give the excuse, well, he has to be a politician, or he's a politician for all the people. He just can't be politicians for Black folks. We need to change that dynamic. We need to put our people in first position. We need conscious Black voters, because we see things that's happening now, whether you're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership that's not being talked about among a lot of our people that should be being talked about, and especially among our politicians that should be giving this message to our people, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this debate around immigration, and they're talking about the foreigners coming from other areas, the people coming in from Syria, refugees coming in. All of this is going to affect the well-being of our people here in this country, and it's already affecting it. But to talk about the need for our people to really develop a new mindset in regards to voting, as far as you're concerned.
Well, first of all, two things. One is, just digressing for a second, let me just salute you with the messages that you played from Brother Malcolm and Martin Luther King. They were very powerful, and I absolutely endorse every comment each one made, especially in terms of the economics in our community. And that, of course, is one of the reasons that, as I had addressed earlier, that unfortunately they have to become martyrs of our community because of their great vision as to what must be done in terms of consistent and conscious fight back. As it relates to, let me salute that effort that my brother Kleeman and my other brother,
Amafika.
Amafika are making a move in terms of developing 1 million conscious black voters. Of course, that has been lacking in our community. Your analysis of many people who are elected is just basically a popularity contest so many times, because the real gut issues that impact our community are not being dealt with. But then that's kind of reflection, and that's a failure in the sense of the conscious community, not to force those issues or, you know, give some direction in those various campaigns, you know, to raise them. So we have to also analyze the role of the conscious community in allowing the kind of discussions that go on that are not meaningful, that we should be interjecting with really meaningful discussions. And to that end, I just want to also point out how I, and as a model for future campaigns, our organization early on, they was under another main caucus for Community Progress. The way I ended up running for governor wasn't one morning I said I wanted to be a candidate for governor. I ran out of a concept that at that time in 1984 was called Missouri's first statewide Black People's Convention, which I was the convener as head of this particular organization. At that time, there were no black governors in the United States, not one black United States senator. And we convened this convention in St. Louis at St. Paul AME Church. Had several hundred people in attendance, and we had three purposes. One was to educate whoever was in attendance to state politics. A second was to draw up a platform of issues impacting our people statewide. And the third was out of that gathering to encourage people to run statewide. In Missouri, we had five positions statewide that was coming up for election in 84. That was to be a governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, state treasurer, and state auditor. It was our original desire to have a black candidate in each of those elections. I mean, yeah, for each of those positions. And we naively, and we had a number of the so-called prominent black politicians, the current congressman out of our area, and we brought in the first black elected congressman out of Ohio, Minnesota, the senior congressman here in St. Louis, named Congressman Clay Sr., along with all of the state senators, several state senators in Missouri, a state representative. So we had a house full of elected officials. And the first two objectives were achieved. You know, we educated the folks about state politics. We came up with a concern of, a platform. And I naively thought that somebody, and we was trying to get the so-called prominent politician to run, and I naively thought one would, because that would have at least earned him the title of the first black candidate for governor of the state of Missouri, although we later found out that there was a brother who had ran early in.
Brother Zaki?
So is.
Go ahead.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I ended up running for governor, to practicing what I preach. But in my campaign, I was able to, of course, I did not win, but I was able to get the eventual Democratic nominee, who was the lieutenant governor at that time, to publicly endorse our agenda. So I say that to say again, in terms of one outcome of us having candidates, is that we can force the issues that we're addressing to be placed at the table of the major elections that's taking place throughout America. So I just want to put that out there in terms of the process by which I ended up running for governor. And then I ran a second time, and again, and the first time I ran, many of those same black politicians that attended our conference went with the so-called major white candidates. I ran a second time, and the state was 10% black, and was able to, again, not getting the so-called black elected official support, was able to get in a state that was 10% black, 19% of the votes that was cast, because I addressed a lot of issues across state impacting people in general. And I say all that to say, going back to the vision we have, especially in the southern states, we got men, black men and women, willing to stand up and, first of all, get into the arena to advance our issues for those positions, such as the United States Senate, as well as governorship. I went through those top positions in the United States Senate. In the governorship races, the top three, I didn't put that out there, but North Carolina will have the governor position, and that's 21% black population there. Delaware, 21%. Here in Missouri, 11%, but we do have a brother that's running for lieutenant governor here in Missouri. In Indiana, 9% black. So we had a crossroads as a people, and 2016 could be a watershed event politically. And to that end, that's why, again and again, we're pushing that whole concept of the National Black Political Leadership Conference. Anybody interested in it, they can go to our website, www.uapo.org, or they can give us a call directly, area code 314-477-4629.
Brother Ed?
Yeah, Brother Baruti, question for you. If you're talking to the voting populace about voting, we know economics and voting basically go hand in hand, and a lot of our people don't understand the relationship that economics plays within voting and vice versa, and we know that it's basically a dominant submissive relationship, which I've learned this past weekend with my training sessions. I always look at, with black empowerment, I always, my position has always been, let's do something economically for our people that way, and the vote can be used as a strategy as far as legislation and trying to get some initiatives and things done for our people. I just want to know, as far as the education piece, what would be your way that you would talk to people as far as educating them about getting their needs met? But if they want their needs met, they have to understand that if you want someone that looks like you to do the will of the people that are in your community or your local area, that you have to support them not only with the vote, but you have to support them with your dollars also.
I mean, you just said what I was saying. People have to understand. And that becomes one of the problems in our community, because an excuse from some of the politicians, which is really invalid, because if you love your people, they're getting money from outside the community and not addressing our people. But they use the excuse that our community did not support them financially. And so many times they have to go outside the community. And by going outside the community, then they become beholden to those interests that's outside of the community that really don't care about us. But as you said, that should be, it's some basic responsibilities that the everyday people have to begin to assume, and we have to teach. Responsibility number one is that you do need to vote, you know, especially from the perspective if we're paying taxes. Secondly, you need to know the issues that impact us. Thirdly, you need to financially, as you just said, support those candidates that's willing to articulate the issues of us as a people. Because it does, the reality in this system is that, you know, you do have to have economics in order to wage a successful campaign. So those are And as you just said, we have to teach the people that, and I hope I had addressed it early on, that different positions affects the economics of the community. Let's just say school board members. school board members are empowered to, when you need to build a new school, so you have to hire contractors. If we got people on the school board that's conscious, then of course they would mandate that many of the construction jobs are to go to black people. School boards have designed the curriculum by buying books. Then we got a lot of black book wholesalers out here that you had conscious school board members that then empower those black wholesalers, you know, in terms of supporting them. So that's the direct tie-in in terms of economics and politics. The building of prisons, that's a political decision. Mm-hmm. You know, and either we've the majority of our people are incarcerated because we have allowed folks to be put into positions such as, let's look at prosecutors, attorneys. In the city of St. Louis, I'm going to use that as an example.
Brother Rudy?
You hear me?
Yeah, I hear you now. I think your cell phone is going in and out. But go ahead.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You okay?
In the city of St. Louis, as I was just saying, 50% black, 50% white, we have a prosecuting attorney. Never in the history has been an African-American. Politically, the prosecutor's attorneys determines whether or not a person would be charged with a crime. They determine whether or not the kind of sentence that be placed upon them. And so in many times, if you're white folks that's running it, then who's going to be impacted negatively? It's us. But again, of course, we got to get progressive blacks in there, of course. Sometimes we get some of these Uncle Tom Negroes that just work totally for the system. But the point is that we have to begin to seize political power because those political power decisions impact our daily lives in so many ways. So I hope I answered your question, my brother.
Yes, you did. And I would like to let the listening audience know, or anyone that's listening to us on the Time for Awakening stream, please go to blacktalkradionetwork.com / Black Talk Radio. You'll be able to hear us a little clearer tonight on that stream. That's blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Brother Reg, I don't mean to interrupt you, but Elliot has to tell them that because they can't hear anyone else but him on the stream that's having the problem. So Elliot will have to tell them to go to blacktalkradionetwork.com/blacktalkradio.
Okay. That's, we've been having problems with our stream or Time for an Awakening, but you can hear the simulcast. Just go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/blacktalkradio. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/blacktalkradio to hear the broadcast. We've been having problems with the stream. And just go to, again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/blacktalkradio. Go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, Brother Rudy, to follow up, when we're talking about leadership and looking for candidates to do the will of the community or the group with our agenda, In your mind, what can be done to hold the person that takes the office for the black people? What can the people that vote a candidate in, what can we do to keep them honest and keep them to their promises that they have given to us? We know historically the way the system has been set up. We know we have a lot of black faces in political positions that have good aspirations and have the heart, soul, and minds of the people when they first start. But when they get in the system, most of the times, the majority of our black leadership gets swallowed up into the Eurocentric values and thinking and wanting this position to basically be their livelihood, but not thinking about the people. So what can the people do when they cast that vote to hold those people accountable? And also, what can we do if a candidate is in there and they get amnesia, bump their head, or drink too much of that white Kool-Aid? What can we do to get them out of office?
Well, we let me get the last question first. We then have to replace them with someone who is of higher consciousness and recruit that person to run against that person. We just have to try to work to unseat them, which is a task in itself because, again, getting the conscious brothers and sisters willing to challenge, you know, the bootlickers, for lack of a better word, is a challenge in of itself. And then going back to your, so you're clear on that. When we have someone who crossed the community, then on the ideal conceptual level, we should have somebody willing to replace them, you know, that would be of a better service to our community. Then in terms of for those folks first coming to us with the great ideas and seeking our support, we first of all got to be clear on the issues that they are pushing. So in terms of noting in writing that these are the positions that they take. Secondly, we have to be consistent ourselves by going to whatever position that they are elected to the various meetings or their positions of which they have to serve in that particular position. Say, for instance, school board members. If we support a school board member, then we need to be showing up at their school board meeting and having other family members and other membership constantly at those meetings to monitor those positions, because then as they see us in audience, they may stay on track. So those would be my recommendations moving forward for those candidates that come out to seek our vote. So that means then that there's a lot of work on us if we don't be true to the cause. And so
the school board member.
No, go ahead.
Okay, then. So that means there's greater work, greater organization if we don't maximize our power.
You know, one of the things that that sparked the rebellion in Ferguson, beside the killing of Michael Brown, was the abject oppression of our people there in Ferguson. And I want your opinion on this, because it's one of the planks in 1 million conscious black voters and contributors is community control of police and community policing. Now, we see that other communities, and especially the white community, have community control of police, and they have community policing that are funded basically with our tax dollars. If you look at a lot of these cities, and especially suburban communities, they have town watch, they get new jackets, they get the reflective hats, they get walkie-talkies that are funded from our tax dollars. But when black folks talk about community control of police or community policing, it's always something different. And you don't get a voice from our black politicians to say anything in reference to this, because the pressure from a lot of these police unions around the country. Talk about the need for us, for our people to have control over these rogue police and to also start policing our communities.
Okay, I appreciate that question, but let me, you made me think when you say the unions, police unions. For a number of years, the president of the St. Louis Fraternal of Police here in St. Louis used to crack on a sister who is a co-chair and myself of the Coalition Against Police Crime and Repression because of our positions of calling for, you know, civilian oversight board. You just brought that to my, you know, mindset. But as it relates to, let me go to Ferguson. First of all, I lived in the same complex where Michael Brown, I had lived there back in the 70s and was had organized the complex. At that time, instead of Canfield Green, it was called the Village Apartments. And I had organized a tenant organization calling for the repainting of the complex, which did occur, a better garbage collection system, which we were able to make happen, and the repaving of the streets. But they wouldn't renew my tenant agreement because of my activism, so I had to move out of there. But prior to moving out of there, back in the early 70s, we also had recruited a sister to run for a Ferguson City Council. Fast forward into 2014 when Michael Brown was murdered. And, you know, I was one of the organizers of the Justice for Michael Brown Leadership Coalition, and right out on the front line from day one in terms of the killing of Mike Brown. When I found out, because in my mind, having moved from the community, I'm still thinking Ferguson was at least 50-50 black and white, you know. But when I found out that Ferguson was 64% black, and you had, you had a police force of 53 police officers and only three are black, speaks to shame on us to a great extent as a community, and the lack of political leadership. And as you see it in many communities, we are in majority, or we have a great number of our people, percentage of our people in a lot of suburban communities, yet the police forces do not reflect us. That's why early on, remember I said that one of the planks that we are pushing is the concept of community control of the police department, meaning that wherever percentage of a community ethnically, that community police force ought to reflect the ethnicity of that community. So the Ferguson Police Department ought to be, on a conceptual level, 64% black. But then politically, in Ferguson, at the time of Mike Brown's murder, you had a city council of six members, and only one was black. So again, you know, tying in politics and services in our community, that's a clear example of why we need to have our fair share of representation. And the city council should have been reflective of 64% or the majority being black. Out of that Ferguson Rebellion, we did elect two additional blacks on the city council, although one isn't to the level that I would like to see them getting at. But there has been a qualitative shift in the numbers. So, again, that just gives, you know, speaking to what you had just said earlier, many of the white communities, they're, you know, officers are just friendly to them. Mm-hmm. But in oppressed areas, hell, they hate black folks. You got crackers, you got these white folks coming from the hillbilly areas who don't give a damn about black folks. And let me say one other thing, too. When you say, I'd be remiss if I didn't address this issue, and please pass it on, or you can quote me on it. There has been a spike in murder in the St. Louis area, where they're trying to say it's black on black. Man, I would not be surprised that we got some killer vigilante police officers out there, or some KKK folks coming in and doing some of these killings, and then it's projected black on black. Same thing in Baltimore. That's supposed to have been a total spike in the murder in Baltimore, coming after the rebellion in regards to what happened to Freddie Gray. We as a people wake up and smell the coffee in terms of what's taking place in our community with this murder and mayhem, and not be so quick, especially when they say these murders are unsolved, to be blaming it on each other. That's a side note that I just wanted to put out there for your audience to chew on and reflect.
Okay. Brother Reggie.
Hello?
Good, Brother Reg. I guess, Brother Baruti, you were just talking about the spike in a lot of these crimes. A little while ago, and clear this up for me, because a lot of the news coming out of Ferguson and St. Louis is always sketchy and slanted. it was a white group down there that was walking around with guns when the police was out. The truth seekers or the
Oath keepers.
Okay.
Right.
Talk a little bit about who are those people? What were they doing?
Well, first of all, a couple of things. They were calling themselves being there to express their right to bear arms. That's first of all. You know how that Ku Klux Klan mentality.
But they marched alongside them. But they marched alongside of the police.
Right. And they were there also to be the protector of the businesses in that area. That was their projection.
Okay.
You know, ideally, and we're not organized enough to, you know, we should have had our own peacekeepers with that, you know, with some brothers who have those skills and doing likewise and having our expression similar to what they did. But anyway, that's another issue.
Reg, you back with us? Reg, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Brother Baruti, I got a twofold question for you, my brother. It's first is in relationship to black folks, and then a second to people outside of our group. When we collaborate...
Reggie, can I interject something before you...
Sure.
Before I forget, I'm at 68, and sometimes you don't express yourself, and it won't come back. Going back to your message from Dr. King, you know, in terms of the economics, I just want to put out there, too, and I salute those, our community. We pushed for a boycott of Black Friday around the Thanksgiving holidays and the Christmas holidays this past year. And there was an 11% drop in retail sales here in the St. Louis metropolitan area. And I only say that because along with politics, we also must deal with putting some pain on these white folks economically. I just want to put that out there.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
You're good, actually. And when we do that as a follow-up, it needs to be concentrated and focused. Now, that what I've been seeing is a lot of times there's like 20 different places people want to do that, but it's not focused anywhere where it could have an impact where they know, hey, this happened to us, and let the word go spread that this could happen to a whole lot of others if you guys don't take us seriously of our impact and what we can do when we unite our forces together as black people. What I wanted to say to you is about collaboration with black folks and also with people outside of our group that understand our agenda and where we're going. And let's deal with black folks first. If you have two separate groups that have an agenda that's similar, okay? Now, when we come to collaborate, I just want to know your feelings about organization. Should any groups collaborate with another group if they're not organized and don't have a vision, don't have a platform of where they're going? Because I see that happening a lot of times, and it's basically one group swallowing up another group. When the group that's organized swallows up the group that's not organized, it could work sometimes, but most of the time it won't, because the people in the group that is just free-willing or freestyling, they don't know about keeping time. They don't know about keeping your word. They don't know about teamwork, following orders, following leadership, command, you know, chain of command, and any of those types of sorts of things. So I just want to know your thoughts about that.
Well, you know, first of all, any kind of movement, you got to be organized. You know, we are up against the most organized system of military, from the armies and the navies and the air force to the militarized police components, the FBI, the CIA, the state police, the local police, the media, they're organized. So we have to be organized as a people if we'll be moving forward. For those who are disorganized, then I say that they have to get organized, and if those organized groups just motivate them or overtake them. I mean, we got to have organization. That's the bottom line. We got to have organization, and the organization has to be around people of like-mindedness, you know. And so that's where I'm at with that, you know. And if a person is disorganized, then that then they're not effective for our community. How can you organize our community when you're not organized? That's a contradiction in and of itself.
So, great. Thank you for that. Now, on the same vibe or the same stream of thinking, when either politically, economically, or otherwise, when we attempt to collaborate with folks across the street, whether they're white or any other color or nationality, I see that a lot of times, as you just stated, we're not organized when we get ready to go to deal with them and to collaborate. And if we are organized, we're half-stepping organized. And what happens is we're always seem to be the proverbial weakest link on the chain. And I just want to get your thoughts about when we get ready, a black organization gets ready to collaborate with anyone, we should be coming from a position of strength instead of weakness.
Absolutely. And let me be clear in terms of our organization historically have had some collaboration not only with black organizations but outside of our community.
Mm-hmm.
But we stand on the principles of the issues that we address, and the other organizations, they know clearly where we at in terms of our positions, because we're not changing nothing that we feel is in the best interest of our community. And so we can easily collaborate outside, you know, with other entities outside of the community, in which we have in the past, and we still do into the future. Because clearly we understand that in America, the issue is really twofold. One is, it is a class struggle, even though many white folks are ignorant and been fed a racist line and they embrace it. But also at the same time, many of them are just as oppressed as we are, and they are unconscious of it, just as there are a number of black folks who are unconscious about our circumstance. So we're clear on that as one issue. And then secondly, it is a race problem simultaneous, if you understand what I'm saying. So so if you're clear on those two issues, then for the various situations that you enter into, then you can handle it as we see it.
Okay, great. Hold on for a minute, Elliot. We had Brother Antar Lumumba as a guest speaker on Saturday. And he made a statement, and it resonates with me. And you actually you laid it out in various different facets. But I just want to put this out there, and I just want to ask my last follow-up question. And I'll let Elliot continue. When we look at oppression, he has stated, if we want to look at organizational skills, white supremacy and oppression is the greatest model of organization. And I want to follow up with you with this. Any black organization that is looking to do something for our people, and you just used the word future, and we're talking about voting as a mechanism, we're talking about cooperative economics as a mechanism, what is the 5, 10, 15, or 20 year plan of going forth of trying to unify our votes? And I'm just asking this question because when white people go to gentrify a community, they don't think about gentrifying a community last year. They think about gentrifying a community 5, 10, 15 years prior to actually implementing their plan. And if we're talking about being strategic, we're talking about this is white folks playing chess or playing checkers, We have to have the same mindset of what we want the future to look like for black people 5, 10, 15, and 20 years out in the future. I think any organization that's not thinking like that, and I also know that we have to be flexible, but I think any black organization is not thinking like that, that we're not prepared to go into this war against white oppression or white supremacy if we're not thinking like that, because that's how they think about locking our children up, our men up, our women up. That's how they think about us when they're talking about educating and not educating our children. They think about our children when they want to put them on medicine. They're looking at third or fourth grade, special education, pushing them into that. They know that by the time they get out of high school, when they have that label of being a special education student, more than likely they're going to be able to fill up that jailhouse. They know when that jailhouse is filled up with us, they're going to get that free labor. When they get that cheap labor, they know they're going to have more money, equity, to be able to give out to their shareholders and for the different corporations. So I'm just saying, if we're not thinking like that 5, 10, 15, 20 years out, then what is it that we're doing? I just want your response, my brother.
Well, I mean, I totally agree with you, but I want to add a couple of things. First of all, in terms of projection, our organization projecting that starting in 2016, but probably will not be into 2020 or 2024, that we need to seize state power in at least 5 southern states, okay? That's politically. Organizationally, we're saying that we want to project a membership, and we say our organizations should be projecting an increase of membership of folks of their like-mindedness. We say of like-mindedness within our organization. We're projecting a membership drive of 144,000 by September 27, 2017, you know, as far as a projection. So I just want to put those two out there. Then also, another variable, though, and I want this to be seeming as an excuse, but one of the things that they have, the system has, that's way over us, is that many times they, with their billions of dollars, they plan 24/7 because they don't have to survive. Brother Elliot have to survive economically. You may have to survive economically. So myself, I have to survive economically. So our concentration of a plan 24/7 is not as detailed as does that make sense to you?
In terms of
reality, I'm just trying to break it down as be as many young people as real as I possibly can in terms of what we have to overcome. And that's why progressive organizations need to be funded so the leadership is free and free of the kind of worries of day-to-day survival, you know, as you also at the same time fighting the beast that we fighting.
So Elliot, let me say one thing and I'll be done. I'm sorry, my brother.
That's no problem.
I have to say this. So with that point that you just made, if you have an organization and you have leadership that cares about the agenda and carrying out, not talking, but carrying out an action plan for the people, you're saying that a black organization will need membership to be able to secure the freedom of the leadership or the body that's doing the work, the time, that 24/7, that they could plan to do the things for our people and put it in action, and that would take money. Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely. Let me just say this.
Okay.
Let me give you
This is Scotty from Black Talk Radio. I don't mean to interrupt, but I need to interject that we have some programming post come on air, Political Prison Radio, so we need to transition.
Okay. Thank you, Scotty.
You're welcome.
Okay. Okay, let me say this real quickly. That's why we're projecting in terms of the concept of 144,000 like-minded people willing to do an annual membership fee of $25. That will generate a $3.6 million budget, where then we can hire and employ young people like yourself to do the work of our community based on the history of actual work that our organization has taken, have done over the years, and we have a track record. In fact, real quickly, just this year, we shipped 10,000 textbooks to Ghana as part of our international effort to support our brothers and sisters in Africa. One year, we shipped 10,000 textbooks to Ethiopia. Another year, we shipped 450 boxes of food and water and clothing and medical supplies to Haiti. Another year, we shipped 450 boxes of clothing and medical supplies to Zimbabwe. I'm using that as examples that organizations can't just be talking the talk. They have to have a proven track record. And, and those organizations that have that kind of track record, then the community ought to be supporting it. But also, we have to have dollars in order to move forward.
Brother Rudy, I want to thank you for being with us. Before we leave the air this evening, give out the contact number where people can get more information and to attend the National Black Political Conference there in St. Louis.
Okay, the conference, the National Black Political Leadership Conference, will be Friday, October 30th, and Saturday, October 31st, from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Greater St. Mark Family Church. Registration for it is $35. If you're interested, you can go directly to our website, which is www.uapo.org, or they can call directly area code 314-477-4629. Brother Elliot and my other brother, I truly appreciate the conversation tonight. May God bless each and both of you, and both of you keep up the great work that you're doing.
We'll do this again, my brother.
Brother Baruti.
All right.
You'll be hearing from Brother Donnie Bradford and as far as representation for 1 million black voters and contributors at the conference.
All right. I look forward to hearing from you.
Talk to you soon.
All right. God be with you. All right.
I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion as always, and we'll be back next week, Lord willing, without the technical problems, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.